Well, let me welcome everyone here to the MAA Carriage House. This is now getting to be quite a habit for us of having these distinguished lectures, and we're delighted that the National Security Agency is continuing to fund our program. We hope that you will keep watching your email inbox and our website for announcements of other programs. Today, April 1st, is also the first day of Mathematics Awareness Month. And for this month, we actually have three distinguished lectures. So stay tuned for announcements of those. Actually, they're already on the website, and email announcements will be going out. The theme for this year's Math Awareness Month is math and sports. So we're off to a good start tonight. We're going to hear a little bit about some math and sports. But also, if you look at the MathAware website, and it is MathAware, the Math Awareness Month website, which is mathaware.org, you'll find lots of stuff about math and sports, including the four posters that we produce to commemorate this year's Mathematics Awareness Month, which I think are very attractive. And I think I'm allowed to say that. I didn't design them myself, so I'm not going to take any personal credit, but I find them quite appealing. So take a look at those, and they'll also be, one of those is in this month's MAA Focus newsletter, and I believe they're also available as a set of four. There are actually four posters. And they're available for $10 to cover the shipping and handling. We're not charging for the posters themselves, but you can get a set of four through the MAA Service Center for the cost of shipping and handling. For tonight's lecture, I want to turn over the floor to Doug Inslee, who's one of the MAA vice presidents on the faculty at Shippensburg University, who has some sort of history with our speaker tonight. And I'm going to we're going to have the privilege of letting Doug introduce tonight's lecture. Thank you, Doug.
Sure. Thank you, Michael. It's a great honor to get to introduce my friend Scott as our speaker tonight. I've known Scott since we were in graduate school at Carnegie Mellon. He was in the statistics department, I was in the mathematics department, and we kept crossing paths because of our mutual love of sports. Although I don't think that I come anywhere close to Scott's level of frenzy on the subject. The one thing I would say about Scott personally is that he's about the nicest person you would ever meet. He's the guy that organizes the softball team and teaches the Chinese kids how to play, the Indian kid, you know, how to transfer from cricket to softball, and absolute, you know, patience with everybody. Always the one organizing the pools. And so for someone who takes sports very seriously, you couldn't find a nicer guy on the field. I will challenge you to think of what the name of the statistics department softball team was. So you can think of what the name of that team was. I think it still is.
Right? It still is?
It still is, yeah. So if you have a connection to CMU, you probably know, so that's cheating. So think of the most obvious, stupid name you can for a statistics softball team. It's probably worse than that. So Scott comes to us by way of Minnesota originally, to Carnegie Mellon for graduate school, and then was on the faculty at Texas A&M before he went into business with his dad as a consultant, and his company, Berry Consultants, does clinical studies, statistics for clinical studies for pharmaceutical companies and companies that design medical equipment. What else did I want to say? That's very impressive. But this is really the reason that those of us who know Scott are proud to know him, because occasionally we'll see his byline or references to it in things like ESPN magazine, which to us is much more impressive than any math term we could possibly write anything for. So it's that interest in sports, not the clinical trials and things that he does, that have brought him to us today. I'm very proud to turn over the floor to him. He's going to talk about his Tiger Woods a winner, and I won't even make a joke about that. I will say that I know the title has been that since last summer at least, so well before all of the Tiger Woods stuff has happened. I don't know if the answer has changed based on what's been going on the last few months. But please welcome Scott Barry.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Doug. That was great. You notice he said that he he couldn't match my frenzy in sports, but he didn't say he couldn't match my ability in sports, which he knows. He knows he certainly can. Thank you very much to everybody for coming. I'm certainly honored to be here. I'm going to go through, and this is an exploration of this, and I will present this, but please stop me at any time. Don't wait for the end to ask your questions. Let's stop me in the middle, and we'll chat about all of this. This grew out of, I wrote a column in Chance Magazine, which comes out quarterly, and I wrote an article in each one of them called The Statistician Reads the Sports Page. So each one of them would grow into an analysis I would do of a phenomenon. And so a lot of this culminated from many of the different things I did in this to come to this. And in part, I've been thinking about the idea, and I'll talk about that a little bit. Tiger is, it's a strange title because, in part because of the reverence I have for Tiger as a golfer. And he matches guys like Babe Ruth, Wayne Gretzky, Wilt Chamberlain, and I'll avoid the joke that goes with Wilt Chamberlain in this as well, Nicklaus and Bonds, in that they just did freakish statistical things. Babe Ruth hit more home runs in some of his seasons than any teams did. Things like that. Tiger's stats are really that good. So the title of Is He a Winner is a really strange title, and I'll get to what I mean by that. I think it's not only arguable, I think it's true, and I've argued that he's the best golfer of all time, and he's only 33 years old, which is about the maximum age for a professional golfer. 31 to 35 turns out to be right about peak performance for a professional golfer. And it's interesting because he dominates golf to a level I would have said was impossible 10, 15 years ago. When he plays in a golf tournament with 143 other players, and in a sense, he's playing their best. He has to beat the maximum of 143 players, and they're all of just phenomenal ability. For him to win the rate he does is staggering. So, again, how can I ask the question if he's a winner or not? Well, some of his accomplishments, he's played in 253 PGA Tour events. He's won 71 of them. He's played in 50 majors. Majors hold a special stance among professional golf. There are four of them a year, and most experts, which I make fun of more than anybody, think that those are the tournaments that really determine how good a golfer is. And there is some truth to it because they tend to be the tournaments where the best players in the world come and play. The money's the best, the notoriety's the best, and so they are the best fields in golf of players, and so there's some truth to that, but for whatever reason, they hold a special place in golf. And he's played in 50 of those, and he's won 14, and he's finished second four times. There's an interesting aspect to this. Jack Nicklaus has the record for most majors. He won 18 majors, and he finished second 19 times. And so the question of whether Tiger's a winner, a lot of people point to this as a fact of him, the fact that he's so good that when he gets close to the lead, he wins. And he has this ability, special ability, to win a golf tournament. In 2009, last year, which most people say is a bad year because he didn't win a major. He didn't win any of the majors, but yet he played in 17 tournaments and he won six of them. He holds the scoring record in all four majors, if you consider the scoring record as winning by the highest differential. So he won the Masters by 12, the U.S. Open by 15, the Open, or what we refer to as the British Open by 8, or the PGA Championship he won by 5. All of those are the record. I think the PGA is tied for the record. And now I get to the point that is the harder to quantify attributes of an athlete. I wrote a paper that compared players from different eras. So the question was, how do you compare Babe Ruth to Mark McGwire? How do you compare, say, Tiger Woods to Arnold Palmer? They never played in a common field of play, but yet they played against players who played against players who played against players who did overlap. And so maybe we can do some modeling to try to see what players would do if they would have been in different years. And it was interesting. This came out and got a good deal of press. In Canada, they went nuts over my ratings of hockey players. I actually rated Marlowe, and he was a better scorer than Gretzky was. He came out of the model as a better scorer, which outraged a lot of people in Canada, despite the fact they're both Canadian. And in the UK, all they want to know is about golf. They asked about Nicklaus and things. And in the U.S., all they cared about was baseball. So it was very distinct who asked questions about what. And I did a radio talk show in Winnipeg. It was about 5:45 in the morning. I got up. The first thing they said is, okay, what is a guy from Texas doing writing about hockey? What is it? And I said, well, I grew up in Minnesota. And they said, oh, that's okay then. So in fact, I grew up in Minnesota. I was okay to talk about hockey. But somebody called up, and I had rankings, and they were purely on the ability of players to score. And I say that in the paper. I come straight out and say, look, Bob Uhr, a defenseman, is not going to come out as high on here because this measures the ability to score. And the first one that calls up and says, look, your mathematical models, they can't measure heart. The players that played 40 years ago, they had heart. And the players now, they don't have any. And so, of course, my response was, well, if they had that much heart, they should have scored more. There's a lot of this that goes on, and it goes on with Tiger Woods, that they refer to him. He wears a red shirt every Sunday. Sunday's the last day of the golf tournament. And he wears a red shirt. It signifies he's in the hunt and he's going to win the tournament. And golf experts will tell you that it's not so much that maybe he rises to the occasion, but he scares everybody else in the golf tournament to the point that he wins. A lot of tournaments, he leads by two or three shots going into the last day, and they all seem to fall by the wayside, and he wins. There are effects such as clutch hitters. They have the drive, and they have confidence, and all of these things. And now another one is what I'm going to refer to as being a winner. Do winners exist? And what I mean by a winner is somebody that has a certain level of golf ability, but they win more than their natural ability dictates they should. So, for example, if they're tied going into the last hole, they have the ability to score better and win the tournament. So you wouldn't say they're a better golfer than somebody, but they win more. So somebody might say Phil Mickelson and Tiger have the same ability in golf, but yet Tiger's won 14 majors and Phil has won three or four. For a while, he hadn't won any. And so the question is, do winners exist? Do players have that ability to win more than their golf ability dictates? So, for example, in the 2007 Sports Illustrated, 2007, he finished second or third, top five in both the Masters and the U.S. Open. They're the first two majors of the year. So Sports Illustrated writes, whatever happened to Tiger Woods? You remember him, right? Big smile, flawless putting strokes, and an aura so intimidating that other players' mock turtlenecks would get tighter at the very sight of his name on the leaderboard. Now, I love this sentence. Woods may lead the PGA in victories, scoring average, and all-important FedEx Cup points, but the story of the year in golf is that something has gone missing in Tiger's game. So he's just won the most. He scored the best. He leads in everything, but something's gone missing. And what's gone missing is he didn't win one of the first two majors. The most ruthless closer the sport has known has developed a vulnerability when it matters most, and it cost him last week's U.S. Open just as it did the Masters earlier this year. He went on, by the way, I think he won the next two or three majors after that. The next U.S. Open was the famous one where he hurt his knee and all of that. So a lot to talk about his being a closer, the attributes he has to win a golf tournament, intangibles. Typically what I say is every time you hear a term like that, what the person's really saying is, I can't explain the randomness, so I'm going to figure out a word that explains it. Chemistry. Oh, the team had really good chemistry. What that means is, they're doing differently than everybody expected, and their ability And we can't explain it any other way than to say, well, they really get along really well. They hang out well together. And sports is famous for this. Random things happen in sports, and announcers, commentators, writers, fans have to give a reason why it happened. You never hear an announcer say, huh, it's just random. It's just funny things we can't explain. They don't have a job anymore if they can't explain it. So many things that I've studied in these columns have been what I believe are myths, that really it's randomness. It's nothing but randomness. And so the question is winning randomness for Tiger? So what is it? And many of these effects have been studied a great deal. The hot hand, whether players are streaky in sports. Streaks exist, but do they exist more than we expect due to randomness? Clutch players, certainly in clutch situations, people do well, people do poorly. But is it any more than you would expect? A-Rod is famous for doing very poorly in October, though last October he actually did quite well. Jeter is famous for having great October's playoffs. Doing really well in the playoffs. He has some ability to rise to the occasion. The confidence. When they interview somebody in the basketball tournament who had a good day, oh, I felt confident. Or the point guard will say, boy, he really was confident today, so I kept feeding him the ball. Over and over again. The question is, I don't doubt they felt confident. The question is, did it actually affect anything? Does it matter if somebody feels confident? Chemistry is a famous word. And so the question is, do any of these actually exist, or are they other names for randomness? And of course now, whatever happens going forward, if he does better, if he does worse, if he does the same, they will say it's because of his latest marital mishaps, for sure. It will be the explanation regardless of the data. Many of these effects are what are called the regression effect in statistics. Most of my time I spend doing clinical trials, decision analysis in the pharmaceutical world. This is something that drug companies don't understand well either, and really bad decisions are made because of it. And it was really what attracted me to math and statistics in the first place. I kept losing my allowance on bets, and it turned out to be the regression. I was 11 years old in 1976, and George Foster was on pace to break the record for home runs in baseball. And halfway through the season, he had 31 home runs. And I was sophisticated enough to double that. And that was 62, so he was on pace to break Babe Ruth's record, and I bet my dad that he would break the record. And he did. He ended up at 52, I think he ended up. That went on and on and on over and over again that I would do that. Halfway through the football season, a guy was on pace to break the record, the rushing record. And invariably, it never happened, and I never understood why. Players, on average, do half as well the first half as they do the second. What I failed to recognize was the regression effect, that those players were very specially selected, and they weren't nearly as good as their performance because nobody's ever been that good until Barry Bonds came along. Drug hated Barry Bonds. But essentially, we know from the population of players that nobody's ever been that good. The likelihood they're actually that good is really small, and that comes through modeling the population. So I'm going to do that with Tiger today. And the question is, do winners exist? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a mathematical model for Tiger Woods, the golfer. The mathematical model will have no special ability to win. It'll have his ability to play golf. I'll model every single professional golfer with a mathematical model, I think a pretty good one, for predicting what will happen. And then I will simulate seasons, simulate careers for all these golfers, and I'll see what happens. And underlying this model, a hypothesis, is that there's no effect. The mathematical model has no special ability for Tiger Woods to win, and I'll see what happens. So that's the approach. It's an approach I've used a number of times. I've used it in sports. It's a great example I refer to as the 15 Tarzans. Johnny Weissmuller in the 20s, who played Tarzan in the movies, and he was an Olympic swimmer, and he swam the 100 meters and won the Olympics. If you take his winning time in the 20s, it was 24, 28, I can't remember, and you take that winning time in the 100 meters in the 20s, and you say, okay, Johnny Weissmuller, you can swing 15 of those in a row, which he certainly couldn't back then. Right now, he wouldn't win the 1500. He would actually get destroyed. So the modern athlete is faster than 15 consecutive Tarzans at swimming. So I was fascinated by, why does that happen? Why in 80 years is it that the fastest swimmer then could not even swim in the same pool as the swimmers did? So my hypothesis was is that the biggest reason is the size of the population. There are so many more people that invariably the elite athletes are going to be that much better. It flies in the face of what most people would tell you is that it's training and methods and diet and all of that. So I set up a model where it's only population, where you select the best player out of best person out of populations and tried to predict winning Olympic time. And just simulated that process and set up that model. It does very well in swimming. In almost every sport, it did very well. It actually did poorly in some of them. Winter speed skating, it did very poorly at. And I think there's reasons why the model doesn't fit, which came out of that. We do this in building clinical trials. We're building it, what are referred to as adaptive clinical trials, rather than running 400 patients and looking when it's over and realizing, shoot, I wish we'd have done something different. We actually allow the trial to change and modify, and we simulate these. We simulate all the clinical trials ahead of time and optimize it and maximize it. And so we do a lot of this simulation stuff. It's done in climate models all the time, explaining greenhouse effects, things like that. The recent controversy over screening mammography, where they came out and said that you don't need to screen every year, you don't need to start till you're 50, and this was Obamacare, this was catastrophic, and people were very upset. This came out of mathematical modeling as to what effect screening mammography has. It came out of simulation. They simulated the process and showed that the effects this had. So this is a common procedure that's done. So what are the data I have? I have 8 years' worth of data on every round in all official stroke play PGA Tour events, U.S. PGA Tour events from 1997 through 2004. It doesn't overlap. I haven't updated this in a while, so it doesn't overlap completely. Interestingly, there were 2004 players that played at least one round. My brother was one of them. There were 147,000 rounds played, over 10 million shots. The best scoring average out of the 2004 players was a guy named Chris Downs, who I have never heard of, was 68.75. Tiger Woods is 4. Just the raw average. No adjustments, anything. Chris Downs played 4 rounds of golf in the entire thing. The 2003 BC Open, which is played the same week that most of the pros are at the British Open. And he was shot 13 under par and he tied for 18th place. Meanwhile, Tiger the same week was 1 over par and finished 4th at the British Open. But yet, Chris Downs' average was better. Brings about 2 issues. The first is that not every round is the same. Shooting 73 in the British Open is very different than shooting 73 at the BC Open. It's probably equivalent to shooting about 67 or something at the BC Open. So I need to model the effects of every round. The second aspect of it is he played 4 rounds. He played very few rounds. We know a lot about the population of golfers. If a golfer comes along and plays one tournament and wins it and beats Tiger in his first tournament, we still don't think he's as good as Tiger. We probably don't think he's nearly as good as Tiger, even though that's the only data we have. And it's because we have thousands of players who have played, and one of them is that good. It's more likely he performed much better than his actual performance, and he isn't that good. That falls directly out of modeling the population of players. So what we do is we model the score, the round, the golf score in any particular round is normally distributed, I'll talk about that in a minute, with a mean that is the ability of the player. Theta I is the pure ability of the player. There's an additive effect due to the particular round. So every particular round in every tournament has an effect. So the third round of Augusta might be terrible weather. The third round of the Masters may be terrible weather. There's an additive effect that everybody's scores go up by an additive amount. And then there's a variability in that. And now we model the population of golfers. So this is the population of professional golfers, normally distributed with a mean and a variance, which I don't know. And so we're going to model these with distributions as well, prior distributions. This is called a hierarchical distribution because of the hierarchy. So we have this distribution that has parameters that are unknown, so we model these as well. So part of the conclusion of this analysis is what is the population of professional golfers? We're going to model each one of them. Now, if a player has a really good performance and a little bit of data, it pulls them into the middle, and it's referred to as shrinkage, regression to the mean. And this has had an enormous effect in many applications, in medicine, modeling of patients, where somebody who pulls out from the population gets regressed in, and the estimates are much, much better. And we see this in over and over again, this effect. Yes. Yep. A priori, they're independent. The data goes in, the 10 million shots, I can't remember how many rounds there were, a million rounds, went into the estimates of this. We're going to get an estimate for every player, the difficulty of every round, which is kind of fun to look through, and then the estimate of the variance of a single round, the estimate of the variance of the golfers, and the estimate of the mean of the golfers. These priors don't have much effect on the final conclusions at all. So in this 8 years worth of data, Tiger Woods comes out as the highest ranked. So what I'm summarizing here, this is the posterior mean. It goes into a Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm that calculates the posterior for all of the parameters by simulating each one of them. So it's actually doing a 2008 dimensional integral by simulating values of theta, values of mu, sigma, the gammas. That's actually more than that because there's a number of gammas as well. So Tiger Woods, the posterior mean for him is 68.48. His standard deviation is 0.12. He played 582 rounds in the data set. Vijay Singh was second and so on. And you notice down here at 371 is Chris Downs, who averaged in his data 68.75, but he's being shrunk to the middle because he only played four rounds, and the rounds were not as difficult as some of the other ones. So his mean is 71.91, which is about 3.5 shots worse than Tiger. Tiger is estimated to be better by about 0.9 shots over the next best player. 0.8. Here is a summary. I don't know how well you can see that. What I've done is made a histogram of the posterior mean of all 2004 players in the data set. And here's Tiger. You can see how far he is from everybody else, and now you see this distribution. It is right skewed in the estimate of these, which I think makes a lot of sense. A number of players get in these tournaments that don't have nearly the ability, and so you get this long right tail. My brother's in here somewhere. Don't tell him I said that. And the line you see is the probability that a player with that ability beats Tiger Woods in a four-round tournament. So I simulate, right? You calculate it. You just get the square root of four in the standard deviation. Four independent rounds playing against Tiger Woods, the probability they would beat Tiger Woods. So what you see is that anybody who's within about four shots at least has a chance to beat him. If they're not within about four shots, which is the median golfer, they don't have a chance to beat him, essentially. The problem is Tiger has to play 140 players that are in this group in every one tournament. If he played one player, he's going to win overwhelmingly over and over again, but he's got to play a whole group of guys. The posterior mean of the standard deviation is 2.81. So if you say a golfer's mean score is 70, a professional golfer, the standard deviation is about 2.81 after taking round effects. The standard deviation of professional golfers is estimated to be about 2.33. And the mean of these is 73.84. Here is a normal quantile plot for all 10 million, it was about a million scores. And if the scores were truly normally distributed, you'd see these individual dots on this line with the theoretical quantiles. What you see is a longer right tail. The normal model doesn't predict as many 90s as you would see even on the PGA Tour. So you can see some really big numbers, which is not surprising. And you see less good scores here than you would. So it's a shorter left-hand tail, which I think makes sense. So the normal model isn't perfect by any stretch. It seems to do a pretty good job. It gives a little bit too much probability for low scores and certainly doesn't give the high scores, but we don't care much about these for the most part. Here's again a repeat of the probability somebody beats Tiger in four rounds. This is a histogram for everybody that has at least a 1% chance. So I took the distribution of 2004 golfers and I said, what's the chance you beat Tiger in four rounds? And I plotted a histogram of that for only those players. And you can see the best person here, Vijay Singh, has about a 28% chance to beat Tiger in a four-round golf tournament. And then you can see, you can almost count the players. Everybody else has less than a 0.1 probability of beating Tiger in four rounds. But again, he has to play 100 guys in a weekend. So I simulated tournaments of various sizes. I simulated tournaments where I took the top 144 golfers and the probability he would win and the probability he would be second. I took the top 10, the probability he would win a tournament there. I simulated what I referred to the whole world. I essentially took the 2004 and assumed nobody else could beat him anyway. And so I threw the whole world into a single golf tournament, which you could imagine the tee times would be a little difficult. But he has a 12% chance of winning that worldwide golf tournament. Interestingly, what came out of this is the probability he finishes second. It's actually much smaller than the probability he wins. And what happens is, what determines whether he wins or not, if you think about it, the maximum of 143 players doesn't have a terrible amount of variability, actually. You can predict pretty well what he has to do to win if you just knew the average of the rounds. And so the determining factor of whether he wins is how he plays. If he plays in his top 30th percentile, he wins. And if he plays really well, he blows the field away. And so for him to finish second is actually a really, really small window. And so the data matches very well with what the simulations come out, that he shouldn't finish second that often. Nicklaus was very different. Nicklaus wasn't that much better than the players. He played a lot of tournaments, and so he had similar probabilities of finishing both. The other thing is you can finish second more often because of ties. If you're tied for second, there's not a playoff. So in that sense, you will have more second place finishes. Yeah? You're stretching your hand. I didn't hear the question. So now I'm going to take from simulating a tournament to simulating his career. So I took every tournament that he played in. I took every individual that was in the tournament and simulated four rounds for them, and I replayed his career up to this point. Then I did it again and again. I did 10,000 careers for Tiger Woods. Based on the mathematical modeling, so essentially I simulate a value of theta for each season from everybody's posterior, play the season, draw a new value of theta, new ability. So the variability in the estimates is built into the simulation as well. I don't throw in the posterior mean. I actually simulate from the variability. So in some of the seasons, he actually wasn't quite as good. In some, he may have been better just from the posterior distribution. There were 147 tournaments, so there were some tournaments he played in that count in the PGA that aren't in my data set. There were some non-stroke play tournaments that I didn't do when they play Stableford or match play. That's not in there. So there are a number of tournaments that didn't get into the data set. Of the 147 tournaments he was in, he won 36 of them, actually. I'll call that Tiger. The mathematical Tiger I refer to as Robo-Tiger. Tiger won 35 out of 106 tournaments not in the data set. So he actually did better in the tournaments that were not in the data set. Some of them are more recent. So the year since 2004 I've included in this data summary. Here's the histogram for his number of wins in those 147 tournaments. So I simulated 10,000 careers of 147 tournaments. The fewest wins were down here about 26. The most were up here in the 50s. He was 36 is where he was. This is Robo-Tiger here and what he did in his 10,000 seasons. The mean value of this is 42 wins. Tiger won 36. So Robo-Tiger in the 147 tournaments won more than Tiger did. And Tiger was about a standard deviation below. Very much with what we would expect from Robo-Tiger's career. Tiger fell right here. That's his observation we have. We know he did a little better than the tournaments that aren't in this data set. So I think right dead on, actually, this is the cumulative distribution for number of wins on the right-hand side. So then I took the... the second thing I did was I worried that maybe the variability in Tiger from year to year, so I actually fit the model separately in every single year and then simulated the single year effects to see what would happen. Interestingly, in 97, that was his first season. I think that was the year he won the Masters by 12. And he came out just behind Nick Price here in 98, just behind David Duval. And then from 99 on, he was the best. 2000 was the year he won three of the four majors and completely dominated in there. He's a shot 1.6 shots better than anybody that season. And he continues to be the best every year from there. So I took those individual values, and he had a mean of 40.3. So he won slightly less in that simulation with a standard deviation of 5. Again, very consistent with the actual number of wins he had of 36. So now we get to the majors. He played in a few majors as an amateur, so I left those out of the simulations. So as a professional, he played in 50 majors, and he won 14 of them. I simulated each of the 50 majors, and my data set only goes up to 2004, so I just repeated the 2004 tournaments in 2005, 6, and 7. The fields are very consistent through time. So I essentially duplicated those to make up for the tournaments that I didn't have in the data set. And doing that, I repeated 10,000 times. Robo-Tiger won an average of 14.4 majors with a standard deviation of 3.2. And the most common occurrence was 14. And again, this is not a model where I look at the frequency of victory and then predict it. I'm simulating every single round based on his average round, based on everybody's round, and trying to reproduce it. And it comes out almost identical to what he did. He won 14. It predicted 14.4. Here's a histogram of Robo-Tiger. It goes up to up here in the low 20s, which of course would be unbelievable. So that happened even in some simulated trials where he doesn't have the ability to win, but just through random variation, he won quite a bit more. He could have won only 5 or 6, and of course they would be talking about him like they talk about Phil Mickelson without the ability to win these majors. And the 50th percentile in the cumulative fell right here at 14. So it fell dead on what he actually won. What I did then is I did the same thing going forward in 2010 and onward in simulating the rest of his career. So if Tiger plays 10 more years with the same theta and his opponents have the same thetas, I simulated 10 more seasons of that and then he quits. He on average, he wins 25.5 majors, and in 99.6 of the simulations, he won more than Jack Nicklaus's 18. He won 19 or more. In 8% of them, he wins as many as 30 majors. If he plays 15 more years of the same ability, on average, Robo-Tiger won 29.5 majors with essentially 100% chance. I think every one of the 10,000 simulated scenarios had 19 or more majors. And the most likely record major in this circumstance, I simulated for, and I look where he won the 19th major, was the U.S. Open at Marion in 2013, is my prediction. Of course, is the rest of his life may interfere with that, but that's the prediction. So the conclusions are, it's this sort of bizarre statistical conclusion, and being a Bayesian, it's hard for me to say this, but it's a lot like a p-value, that Tiger Woods' results are consistent with him not being a winner. His data is exactly what we would expect to have happened if he's not a winner. Now, the question is, what would I do as a Bayesian to continue on? Well, to say, what is the probability he's not a winner? I need to understand what model could be there for him being a winner. So I need to parameterize what it means to be a winner and have some sort of effect that when he's close or something, he gets better. What happens when you model that is you add parameters into it. And you take it, it makes the models less desirable. It's this Occam's razor idea that the simplest model, so any model is going to have a higher posterior probability on this model than any more complicated model because the data fits it exactly. So while I haven't done any alternative hypotheses, which you need in order to calculate posterior probabilities, I know the posterior probability is at least getting bigger. And I think fairly substantially, depending on how you identify or parameterize winning. So my conclusion is, no, he's not a winner. He's just much better than everybody. So he will likely win more tournaments and majors than any player in history, but this does not mean he has some intrinsic ability to win above his pure golf skill. He's just better than everybody. I don't know. Is that a bad conclusion? I don't know if commentators would like this. There's no evidence he has more heart, that he scares everybody, anything like that. He's just much better than everybody else. So that's my conclusion. Any questions, comments? Hatred. Yes, Doug.
Well, okay, I have two questions. First, your father is a well-known statistician. So what kind of father would take a bet with his 11-year-old son on a statistical problem?
That's a great question. I lost many allowances over and over again, and I think his answer would be that was the best investment he ever made. That it turned me in. So I wanted to know why. I wanted to figure out why. And I eventually learned this effect. It wasn't a lot of money, but he took the money. He absolutely did. I remember losing my allowance. And he still does it to this day, actually.
So my real question is, where does the data come from? It's millions of rounds of data. Where do you get that data?
So what started in the chance columns I was writing, I started collecting them, and I downloaded every tournament on USA Today's website because they're text files. And so it had the names of the players and the individual scores. I downloaded it. I went through. Every year I would go through a weekend of just manipulating the data, reading in the characters, matching the names, all of this. So I just kept doing it over. And I stopped in 2004, which I wrote this paper a couple years ago, is why it only goes through 2004. I haven't been able to update it. But the PGA Tour has done something really wonderful. They created what they call shot link. So they now have data sets of every shot that's hit in the PGA Tour. They measure, they have people that walk with every golfer, and they stand in a certain spot, and they click it, and that's where the person's hitting from. So they have essentially a GPS location of every shot that's hit, and I think they try to record what club they hit, but I don't know as though they have that completely. They mark it, are they in the rough, are they in the fairway, are they on the green? So the amount of data that you can now get from the PGA Tour, and I think one of the papers actually in this edition looks at that shot link data. Somebody else did an analysis of that. And so the data that's becoming available is incredibly rich in that. So I did it brute force for a period, but I think you can now download the data.
Yeah, John? You mentioned comparing Lemieux and Gretzky.
Yep.
And I was wondering, what kind of model you use to do that, to compare the scores. Is it similar to this?
So it's very similar to that where I have an effect of every season. So essentially, when you play and you score, you have an ability, say, a Poisson distribution for the number of points you're going to get in a game, model the number of season points. But the season has a parameter. And if you look in the NHL, there are stark differences in the number of points scored per game in the early 80s into the mid-90s. So it's much like the round effect here. I have a season effect for hockey. And what you see that when you match it up is that Gretzky played in the highest scoring era of hockey by far. There was mass expansion. The Eastern Europeans were coming over, and there were a huge number of points scored. And then it started to slowly go down and down, and that's about the time when you came in. The times they overlapped, Lemieux scored more points per game. The other thing Lemieux did, he's always hurt. But every time he played, he scored huge numbers, but then he was hurt. So he didn't, and this was, I kept trying to explain this to people who complained about it, I'm not measuring accomplishments. If you said to me, who accomplished more in hockey, Gretzky accomplished much more than Lemieux did. He undisputably, I would say, the greatest offensive player. But if you measure the raw ability to score points in a game, and you adjust for the ability of the season and the ability of points to be scored, he came out to be slightly higher. So I'm sort of torn there, but I'm measuring something, not accomplishment. So when I did this, the women's Hall of Golf Hall of Fame called me up, and they said, we want you to help us use your model. They were upset I only did men and not women. But we want to use your model to decide who should be in the Women's Hall of Fame. And I told them that this is the wrong model completely. I don't measure accomplishments. Hall of Fame is something different. And you know, if you're hurt and you only play in five tournaments a year, but you win two of the five, mathematically, you're incredible, but you didn't accomplish as much as somebody else who won that. And so it was measuring something different, and so it never really worked into anything. I, of course, tried to weasel my way into something. But I was honest that what my models do is something different. But that's why you see that difference in that. And the same thing comes out of baseball. The same thing comes out of hockey. We get hockey, baseball, and golf. You see these stark effects to the season of when you play. And what happens is you have players that overlap. So you have guys that play with Lemieux, and you have guys that play with Gretzky, and their careers overlap. But you have guys that played with Babe Ruth, and then they went on, and then they played with Jimmy Fox, and then they played with Ted Williams and Reggie Jackson. So you have guys, and you can make a map of players that overlap, and so you can do these comparisons. Now, what comes out of all of these models when we do it is that you can't measure interaction. So everything is an additive effect. So, for example, Babe Ruth played at a time when the equipment was different. If somehow he doesn't match with the equipment of this time, you can't measure it very well. But most of these effects, I'm not a big believer in these various interactions. And so if you believe in the additive effect, you can actually do this mapping of players across time.
I'll raise the other hand.
Yeah, okay.
So you mentioned that you modeled what would happen if Tiger was played at a relatively consistent level over the next year, but you also said that the peak performance tends to be about where he is now.
Right.
So do you have any sense from, or have you looked at the data to see what sort of a likely trajectory of deteriorating thetas might be for time?
So we've done that as a separate project from the prediction. Now, in doing this, I'll point out several things of this. The data that I have here is through 2004, which is 6 years ago. He's 27. So, and the question is, okay, has he gotten better? Well, if you look at the frequency of winning golf tournaments, he actually has. In the last 5 or 6 years, he's winning about 33% of them rather than about 25%. So the data I have are in many ways conservative for predicting forward. So in some sense, he may win more than in just looking at the raw data. Now, he'll start to decline and probably go back to that, so maybe it's reasonable, and I'm taking his fixed number of wins as 14 now. So I'm pretty comfortable with that. Now, injuries, marital issues, things like that, and the biggest thing that would hurt him is if another phenom came along. If somebody came along as good as him, he essentially loses half of his wins. Expected him. So it's the one thing I can't predict is there another Tiger out there somewhere? I don't think so, because we've been here and we've seen thousands and thousands of golfers, and so far there's he and Nicholas. And Nicholas wasn't quite as good as he is. So that's the big prediction thing going forward. So the aging thing, in part of this bridging the different eras, Ted Williams played with Mickey Mantle, things, but at different times in their career. So what we did is we modeled the effects of age. And that's why I said the 31 to 35. So we measured the effects of age in golf, and you get a really steep decrease here down to about 27 years old, and then it really levels off, and then you get a really slow increase, which is bad in golf. So you see something like this on average for golfers. We even allow them, and you can do this with smoothing splines, lots of different models that you can allow each individual to have separate aging functions. You see some guys that really played well and didn't age much at all, and then you see others that sort of come up like this. So we allowed variability in that when we did this mapping, which made different conclusions. We would say, okay, at peak, Lemieux's better than Gretzky, but maybe Gretzky aged better. And we had different conclusions like that. So we did model the effects of age in the big data set where we went back from 1935 through 1996. We took all the majors. And we modeled age, we modeled the individual players and all of that. Interestingly, batting average has a very similar type effect. And it sort of, actually this one came up, where home runs look much more like golf. So home runs, you age better as a home run hitter than you do batting average. And in hockey, relatively speaking, it was a pretty sharp increase in hockey. And then there's Gordie Howe, it was out here. But other than Gordie Howe, though interestingly in the golf thing is Tom Watson's British Open last year, 59 years old, he finished that, which, you know, it's interesting to go back and look at the probability of that, which is always dubious to do that anyway. But you know, out here at 59 to do that was unbelievable. Yeah?
You mentioned in your 15 Tarzan model that I think it was speed skating was the one sport that damped it. Did you have a theory as to why that was the case?
I do, but it's as much guessing as anything. It's not empirically related. Part of it was, it's hard to judge the population of what. So, for example, the population of Texas doesn't matter a whole heck of a lot for speed skating. And the third world countries don't contribute much to that. Well, they may contribute to sprinting and things like that. So it's pretty much, I should have done, you know, certain parts of Canada and you know, Finland and, you know, all of that. So I think that population hasn't changed as much as the world, which is maybe why it didn't fit. But the other thing is, apparently, and I think this is really a big part of it, is that, interestingly enough, the technology of ice has changed dramatically. So there was one of these Olympics a few years ago was phenomenally fast, and you see this huge drop in times for everybody. And it looked almost like a steroid type effect or something like that, but it was the actual ice. And so where you think of running 100 meters, you look, you know, and it gets to the whole accomplishment thing, but you look at Jesse Owens, he couldn't compete at all today. And you can measure that on an absolute clock that he couldn't compete. Now, he accomplished more than people do now, so that's the whole difference there. But the thing is now the clock of speed skating is different because the ice is very good. So I think those two things caused the model not to fit well, which actually pleased me greatly. Because the other thing is how sensitive it is. A good question is how sensitive is the model. Suppose Tiger really had an ability to win, would my model pick it up? And that gets to the whole Bayesian part of I need to simulate certain winning effects that are reasonable and see what happens. So in a lot of these we say there's no evidence of clutch hitters, or it's a really, really small effect. And there's no hot hand effect, or it's really small. It's not nearly where, boy, the guy's 6 for 7, you know, he's a different hitter now than he was a week ago. I mean, it's just, we know that the data doesn't demonstrate that that's possible. But there may be small variations that our methods don't pick up. I answered 4 questions in 1.
Thank you.
You said that your model does not measure accomplishment.
Right.
Can you put a name or give a name to the thing that it does measure?
It measures the ability to shoot an 18-hole round of golf. That's all the model does. So it looks at all the rounds. It doesn't say the final round of the Masters is more important. It doesn't say it's any different than the first tournament of the year. It looks at them and it estimates your ability to shoot a round of golf. In a way, it's a handicap, creating a methodology for a handicap. And then I'm saying, okay, let's assume my model is right. Let's simulate accomplishment. And all it happens to match the model does pretty well at predicting that. It gives some credence to the assumptions that go into the model. Now, other models could simulate the same data, but to me, all I care about is the model that Tiger is not a winner predicts this data reasonably well. So if somebody says, look how much Tiger wins, and that's what they do in the short term. Boy, he won this tournament, and they see randomness, and they say, oh, it was just incredible. Everybody fell by the wayside, and his ability to win, and they, you know, 24-hour sports things, they go on and on about this. When in effect, it was the beauty of sport and randomness, and over his career, he's behaved as someone that doesn't necessarily have the ability to win. So in part, in going forward in this, what I would love to see is that his career follows essentially what it is now. I don't think that if I thought he had the ability to win above his skill, maybe this marital thing screws it up. Maybe it has an effect because there's an intrinsic thing there. But my claim is that there isn't. And he's just going to play golf and he's going to do the same as he always did. And there isn't some mythological effect doing this, or that he doesn't intimidate other players and all of that. Now, if he behaves differently, maybe there's something there.
You didn't take into account injuries.
Right. Right. So I could do that, and I thought about that. I haven't done it in 2 minutes. I haven't gone back and looked at, for example, he played a U.S. Open with a hurt knee and all of that. So I haven't adjusted scores based on guys being hurt. And so if some of them for a long period of time are suffering back injuries and all of that, I've made them worse than their true ability probably is. But the second thing is, in forecasting forward, I haven't simulated that. And so that's a big part as well. So with his knee issues and things like that, if he suffers an injury, it's all out the door. So I've simulated him being in every one of these tournaments. So how would I do that? I would probably try to put in some missing some things, some probably a catastrophic injury, a car accident ending his career, things like that. And I thought that this was really something I haven't learned about. I don't really know, and it wouldn't be model-based. So I wanted to see, without injury, what he would do. Now, if I were really betting and predicting what would happen, I would do that. So when I did the very same model for Bonds and McGuire and Sosa when they were doing the home run thing, I actually put that in. I estimated rates of injuries, rates of missed games, and I put that in the simulation. So you can do that. It's almost, I modeled an independent of performance, and just missing games is what I did. But I didn't do it that it would change your theta, which it probably would in some cases. Yes?
What software package do you use to do your Bayesian modeling?
I wish I had a better answer for you, but these are all home-written Fortran programs. And it's, interestingly, we now license to 5 pharmaceutical companies software to simulate clinical trials, and it has a C# GUI, but underneath our Fortran program simulator. And the reason why, there's 2 reasons. I could have done it in C. I'm old and I know Fortran better, so I did that in that. But the if you try to do this in something like R or MATLAB, especially in the clinical trials, but you're simulating these things, and there's lots of calculations going into each one of these. So you could simulate one season, and you press the button, you wait a second, it comes out. But all of a sudden, you do 10,000 of them now, the time gets really long. And to do it in Fortran, I don't do much MATLAB, but I do a lot of R and a lot of Fortran. And it's almost, in clinical trial simulations, it's about 100 times faster. And you can do one in R, it's not a problem. But to do 10,000 and to do multiple scenarios, it takes much, much longer. So speed is the biggest part of the reason I did that in the Fortran. Because the Bayesian calculation is doing its own simulating of parameters, 2,000 parameters, to get the values. Now you simulate the golf terms, you go back and you simulate the parameters, and that, and it actually is, it can take a long time to do it in something R, which is easier, but it's a Fortran.
Well, let's thank our speaker.